You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Greece's political leaders begin to piece together a new coalition government, we'll be taking a look at what the election results mean for the country and indeed the rest of Europe. Then we'll head a little further east to Kiev to find out how Ukraine is so far struggling to make the most of hosting one of the world's biggest sporting events. With Monocle's bumper quality of life issue hitting newsstands this week, we'll be starting a countdown of our top five cities, asking what makes each one of them tick. Today, it's Munich. And as if that's not enough, we'll be bringing you a final roundup of this weekend's inaugural Monocle Country Fair, including a special performance and interview with Cecilia Stalen.
With a strong melody, you can go so far, whether it's a backline. So I think a strong melody will get you everywhere.
It will indeed. All that and lots more, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has today finished the last leg of her trip to the Norwegian capital with a joint appearance with U2 lead singer Bono. After taking part in the Oslo Forum chaired by Norway's foreign minister, she told a news conference that the reform process had been brought about by the people of Burma and other democracy movements.
First of all, I don't think of this journey as a celebration of my life. I think of it as a celebration of all those people who have supported the movement for democracy in Burma, because it's they who have made it possible for me to come out on this journey.
Bono, who will present her with an Amnesty International Award in Dublin on Tuesday, urged people to raise their voices, saying this could eventually make dictatorships listen.
If you raise your voice that it is heard, whether it's heard by the captors in Amnesty's case or the captive, is open to debate. But I have a funny feeling that military dictatorships are not just about muscle, they're quite vain. I think they read their email and the choruses of boos and hisses that they get. They kind of take the temperature of how much they're getting away with.
The great Conservative leader Antoni Samaras has said he would try to change the painful terms of the European Union bailout programme after being given a mandate to form a new government. The head of the Greek Chamber of Commerce, Konstantin Mikalos, said the business community welcomed the results, but the road ahead was still very rocky.
The business community here in Greece is content with the fact that the pro-European vote prevailed. The majority of Greek voters have voted for Europe, for the Eurozone. What is of great importance, though, now is that seriousness will continue to prevail following this voting process.
Other election news now, with most of the results in for the second round runoff of Egypt's presidential election, the Muslim Brotherhood Party is claiming victory for Mohamed Morsi over Ahmed Shafiq, who was prime minister under the ousted president Hosni Mubarak. Egypt's stock market fell today as many feared the election result will not bring Egypt the stability promised by the country's interim military rulers. The United Nations has said that a large number of civilians are trapped in the Syrian city of Homs by ongoing fighting. Many people have taken refuge from the shelling in a mosque, a church and a school in the city. The UN's Susan Gosher said it was a humanitarian crisis.
When civilians are stuck and trapped in the line of fire, this is a humanitarian crisis. We need to ensure that these civilians are protected. We need to ensure that there's respect and protection for the human life of the Syrian people. There needs to be willingness on behalf of the parties to ease the pain of the Syrian people and to release these civilians that are trapped under the line of fire.
Nepalese security forces have charged at demonstrators at Kathmandu's airport today as protests erupted during the departure of Nepal's Prime Minister Baburam Bhattari, who left for the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. The student protests claim that Bhattari was not eligible to attend the conference as a head of state, as there was currently no effective parliament in Nepal. And finally, the Duchess of Argyll, who lost five pieces of jewellery, including a diamond tiara, at an airport in Scotland, spotted one of them in an auction catalogue after the British Airports Authority sold it off. The Duchess lost a Victorian headpiece and a Cartier brooch, along with three other pieces worth a total of £100,000, after flying back home to Glasgow. Despite reporting the loss to the police, they could not be traced until the Duchess saw her missing brooch in a catalogue. It emerged the airport's owners had found the jewellery just months after it went missing and sold it to a diamond merchant for just £5,000. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's 19.05 in Oslo, 18.05 here in London, 13.05 if you're in New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
After Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Who knew we'd ever get this interested in Greek politics? Even political geeks who always stay up late to watch American election results or can recite the names of the last half a dozen opposition leaders in France would normally balk at talking about the finer points of democracy in the land that gave us the name. But Greece's wide-ranging financial crisis has indeed turned quite a few of us into Greek political anoraks. Today was, yet again, a gripping day of negotiating, haggling, speech-making. Antonis Samaras, the leader of Greece's centre-right New Democracy Party, is still trying to put together a coalition, and so far just one party, Syriza, has said they won't be involved. Whatever happens over the next few days, it will have a profound impact not just in Greece, but elsewhere in Europe and indeed the rest of the world. To discuss the implications further, I'm now joined in the studio by Dr. Vasilis Monasteriotis, LSE's Senior Lecturer in Political Economy of Southeastern Europe. Vasilis, thank you very much for coming to Midori House.
Hi.
Let's start with the big question. If you were to put money on it, will a coalition be formed, do you think, within the next two or three days?
I think a coalition government will be formed. Hopefully everybody realizes that we cannot possibly go to a third election. The markets cannot wait, Europe cannot wait, so the country cannot wait itself. So there will be a coalition government. What we saw today is all the parties putting pressure on Syriza, the radical left, to participate in this coalition government. Partly because they want to empower this new government to have a common voice without much opposition domestically. But I think more importantly, because they want to justify their participation in the coalition government, that they're not the ones that impose austerity, that everybody agrees across the board for the austerity measures.
So in particular, the parties on the left? Yeah, it helps if they have Syriza sort of to protect them inside the tent.
Indeed, PASOK, the centre-left, and the Democratic Left Party, they would both want Syriza to participate, but also the New Democracy Centre-Right Party have put pressure on Syriza to participate. I don't think this has any chance of happening, though.
And there's also an argument that actually maybe Greece's overall democracy will be healthier if Syriza is outside playing the role of a proper opposition party.
Of course, if everybody participates in the government, there will be no opposition in the parliament, and so the people opposing the measures will not have an expression in the parliament. But we're not anywhere near of everybody participating in this coalition government, so there will be opposition. One has to keep in mind, of course, that opposition is not the only part of a democracy. So in times of crisis, it makes sense that everybody puts the efforts together in order to try to improve the situation for the country as a whole. And I think this is a message that has not been internalized enough in Greece.
When we look at what happens next, once there is hopefully a new government, the New Democracy is pinning a lot of hope on the fact that the Troika, the EU, the IMF, and in particular, let's face it, Germany, will give them a bit of a break and say, OK, we will give you more time on the plans that have been put in place. Do you think that will be enough to persuade most people in Greece that these austerity plans are necessary?
Yeah, I'm afraid I cannot be optimistic on that. I wish I could say that it will be enough, but I don't see it happening. There is definitely a realization now in Europe and globally that Greece cannot continue with this austerity, the intensity of the austerity program. So something has to give. Openly, we hear now talking about an extension of the fiscal consolidation schedule, a relaxation of some of the austerity rules. But the problem is that Greece has to undergo strict austerity in order to help the economy recover. And what we consistently get is a double talk. We see some politicians saying Greece needs more time. Some other politicians say in Europe that you know, the memorandum is non-negotiable, the conditions are non-negotiable. Also domestically, we hear politicians saying that, you know, we will renegotiate the memorandum, and at the same time saying we have to undergo austerity. This double talk, I think, is confusing for the people domestically, but also for the markets across Europe. And this is not helping the situation, because it's a lose-lose situation. There's no target, and everybody feels that there's more uncertainty in the system.
Greece has been painted as, obviously partly as victim, but also, you know, lots of people have been saying throughout Europe that, well, you know, this is kind of their own fault. It's, you know, they don't all pay their taxes, and, you know, they've been living beyond their means. Do you worry that there hasn't been enough focus on, you know, the fact that, you know, lots of banks were lending to Greece, assuming its economy was as strong as Germany, and that, you know, countries like Germany have got an awful lot out of Greece being in the Eurozone?
Yes, of course, this is true. I am of the view that one has to fix their own finances first, and you know, make sure their household is operating well before they start criticizing everybody else. There's clear problems with the functioning of the Eurozone. Policy mistakes, if you want, that have been made, that the European leaders were very slow to react to the crisis, and to the Greek crisis in particular, but also the systemic problems of the Eurozone. And partly these problems are being addressed with new policy innovations, if you want. We have now the fiscal pact. We can disagree on whether it's a good step forward or a step backward, but there is policy innovation at the European level. So there is something happening there. The problem with Greece, though, is much more immediate and qualitatively quite different. It has to do with the inability of the country to do basic things, like to collect taxes. You don't have to have a strong Eurozone in order to be able to collect taxes at home. Other countries in the Eurozone manage to collect taxes. So there are problems also, including with clientelism, corruption at the official, sort of the government level, but also throughout the economy and the society. And these are problems that have to be fixed anyway, irrespective of whether the Eurozone operates smoothly or not, irrespective of whether Greece is part of the Eurozone or not. So these are the big problems that Greece faces. And in this occasion, it is a positive thing that it has the support, no matter how stringent, the support of the Eurozone in this process of restructuring both the economy, but also modernizing its public administration and the functioning of the economy.
If you were advising Samaras now, what would be the things that you'd be saying, right, look, this is what I think you should be doing on day one when the coalition government is formed?
I think what people need to see in Greece is that there is a prospect of for what is all the sacrifices that are undergoing. So the first priority for the government would be to show that there is an understanding of the situation that the public is in, and that they offer a prospect. So there must be something that gives to the society the basic means to make a living, an increase perhaps in the unemployment benefit, an extension of social security, and especially healthcare, which is not universal in Greece, unlike most other countries in the European Union. So something
but,
that
I mean,
tells
all those cost money, though.
Well, they will cost money, but they will also legitimize the other measures. And I think this is a negotiating point that the Samaras government or the Greek government can take forward in the negotiations with the European leaders, that we have to show that we have a sensitivity for the situation that the public, you know, the least well-off in the society, the situation they're in. And this would also legitimize the reforms that attack more privileges in particular segments of the economy. I think what we had so far was some attack on privileges, but also at the same time universally harsh measures that affected everybody, and especially the low-income people. And the economy kept going down and down. if there is some sense of social responsibility by the government, then I think, and this needs money, so it needs the support of the European Union, then I think the people will wait to see the measures that will take the economy through to the recovery.
When you look at what's happened over the last couple of years, do you sense much of a shift in people's attitudes towards the way they view society? I mean, we've seen, with one extreme, Golden Dawn getting 7%, and obviously they're very, very different, Syriza, but still a radical party on the left that's done extremely well in the last two elections. And you're talking now about, maybe there needs to be better healthcare and better unemployment benefits. Do you get a sense that the country is looking at itself and thinking these are things we need to do to change, to make ourselves a better country?
Yeah, my concern is that the country has not been self-reflective enough. There's a lot of complaining, a lot of blame shifting. The crisis is not our making; it is part of the Eurozone asymmetry, or the foreign politicians are to blame. So there's not enough introspection. Try to identify what are the problems with the society and the economy in Greece, and how to correct them. And in that sense, also this radicalization politically, as it has been manifested politically with the strengthening of the extreme parties, both right and left, is still within a process of looking for scapegoats, trying to find solutions which put the blame to anybody else than to our own selves. On one level, this is true. On another level, I think the society is slowly moving towards an understanding that it is through, own efforts and sacrifices that the situation will be turned around. People slowly, very slowly, but still they are realizing that the country has lived beyond its means, and that fiscal consolidation has to happen one way or the other. There's different ways, different policies that can be implemented to support this fiscal consolidation program, but there's no other way than to achieve fiscal consolidation. Greeks have not been very fast in realizing that, but I think we'll get there.
And one final thing, Greece played Germany in Euro 2012. Later this week, if you had a choice between Germany putting the brakes on austerity measures, or gifting you a last minute own goal to see Greece through to semi-finals, which would you take?
If we are to stay in the Euro, would rather we stayed in the Eurozone rather than the Euro 2012.
Okay. Vasilis Monasterotis, thank you very much indeed for joining us today on Midori House. You're listening to Midori House.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cosy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service and, of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So, drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, we hosted the inaugural Monocle Country Fair at the weekend. There were goats, there were pirate ships, there was some fantastic food from Sweden, and there was also some music. And we're going to play you a little bit of that music. This is a gypsy swing band called Trio Manouche, and this song is Americano.
Porta cazzone con sta marrete.
Na cupulella cavizia e raisata, passa scampagnando a patulete, come nuova papà per far guardare. Tu vuoi fare l'americano, americano, americano, senta me chi do fa fa. Tu vuoi vivere alla moda, ma se bevi whisky and soda, poi ti senti disturbato. Tu ballo rock and roll, tu gioca a baseball, ma sono lì per Camel, chi te li dà la borsetta di mamma. Tu vuoi fare l'americano, americano, americano, ma se nata in Italia, sieta a me non c'è sta niente a fa. O che la pulita, tu vuoi fare l'americano, tu vuoi fare l'americano. Come ti può capire chi te fa bene? Se tu lo parla mezzo americano, quando sa va l'amore sotto la luna, come ti vieni in capo di I love you? Tu vuoi fare l'americano, americano, americano, senta me chi to fa fa. Può vivere alla moda, ma se bevi whisky and soda, può ti senti disturbare. Tu ballo rock and roll, tu gioca a baseball, ma son lì per Camel, chi te li dà la borsetta di mamma. Tu fa fa l'americano, americano, americano, ma se nata in Italia, sieta a me non c'è sta niente va. O che napulitan, tu fa fa l'americano, tu fa fa l'americano. Whisky and soda, rock and roll. 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 Tu fa fa l'americano, tu fa fa l'americano.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy the rest of the day. Trio Manouche.
Can't go wrong with whiskey and soda and rock and roll, can you? That was Americano by Trio Manouche, who are playing in our event space, surrounded by people saying clothes and books and eating Bill Granger's wonderful food. We've got a bit more music performed at the Monocle Country Fair a little bit later on. It is 18:22. You're listening to Midori House. International sporting events are supposed to be fantastic branding opportunities. The UK is pinning its hopes on a successful Olympics later this summer, while both South Africa and China can look back on the last World Cup and Olympics as branding successes, on the whole anyway. Sometimes it can go wrong though, as anyone who remembers India's catastrophic attempt to host the Commonwealth Games will remember. Ukrainians may be starting to worry that their country will end up in the same boat. So far, their attempts to co-host Euro 2012 have been marred by racism, dodgy infrastructure and political turmoil. To make matters worse, co-host Poland seem to be doing far better. I'm joined now from Kiev by Monocle contributor Bruce Leishman. Bruce, welcome to Midori House.
Hi, Stu.
Are people in Kiev relatively happy with how it's going, or are they a little bit concerned?
Look, you really do owe me one, because I know you're a football fan, and as a result of that, today, against my better judgment, I've been down in the fan zone to see what's going on.
Did you love it?
It was an experience. There's more port-a-loos down there than you'd know what to do with, but given that everyone's walking around with mini buckets of beer, I suppose that's entirely appropriate. And I have to say, everyone's having a great time. It's very dominated by Sweden. The Swedish fans have really taken over Kiev because they are, of course, playing all three of their all of their matches in Kiev. So you know, and I of course always had a fairly always in thought of Swedes as being fairly well put together individuals. But after the trip to the fan zone, I may have to reconsider that judgment. You know, everyone's down there, everyone's drinking beer, the sun is shining, And you know, there's a lot of very, very happy people. So I think on that level, it has been successful. But the fact is, there are just so few people here. France is, of course, playing tomorrow in Kiev. I've hardly seen any French out there, and we know, of course, that the Brits certainly have been put off. So on that level, you know, there are real issues. But somebody who was, you know, who's fairly involved with the, or close to the organisation, told me, you know, in the lead up, you know, a few weeks ago, when a lot of the really negative press about racism really took hold, and their comment was, you know, the expectations on Ukraine are so low that provided the lights don't go out at the stadium, you know, it'll be deemed to be a complete success. And the lights haven't been going out at the stadium, so I suppose that's another tick in the box.
That's something, although, frankly, if the lights not going out is seen as success, and that perhaps says something. I mean, does anyone regret, do you think, hosting this? Because when, you know, Ukraine announced they're going to host it, it was like, this is going to be a coming out party for us. We'll show the rest of the world what we're really like. And on the whole, a lot of the coverage has been pretty negative.
Yeah, it's certainly not what I think the progressive elements of Ukrainian society had hoped for. But what we really have is the Ukrainian government, which is so detached from reality. You know, they're living in their parallel universes of bodyguards and armoured Bentleys. So, you know, their view on the world is completely different. We've seen today, in fact, you know, further charges put against Tymoshenko. Or this time, you know, there haven't been formally announced yet, but it's understood that there will be murder charges against her relating to a murder 16 years ago. And we know that, you know, the deputy prosecutor's office is just going over anything in her past to look to pin on her. And the fact that that's coming out now just shows, you know, how little regard really the Ukrainian government has for, you know, international opinion at the moment.
And when people see what Poland next door is doing, and the fans seem to be having, you know, a better time, there seem to be more fans there, it seems to be sort of going far more smoothly in that country. Does that also annoy people in Ukraine?
I think it does. I think that, you know, there are people in Ukraine that really have wanted this to be a big moment for Ukraine and time for Ukraine to kind of celebrate its, you know, European destiny, as they like to call it. You know, really Kiev and Ukraine, you know, it is on Europe's doorstep. It is a part of Europe, and this was meant to demonstrate that. So there are a lot of people that really are quite shocked and horrified. Ukrainian society isn't at all on the same page with what's going on. Certainly, you know, Poland has shown itself to be a pretty credible player, and that of course has been seen in the way Poland has been conducting itself, though not in these games, but really in the, you know, in the last decade, and really has left Ukraine far behind, but does really form a role model, I think, for progressive elements of the Ukrainian opposition, Ukrainian society.
There's a couple of weeks left of the tournament, or almost just about 2 weeks. Do you think there's time for Ukraine to turn it around and be able to sort of promote a more positive image of itself?
Yeah, I do. And I honestly believe, Steve, you know, if the more people that would come to Ukraine, see what's going on, I think those that are here are enjoying it and do like what they see. It can be a pretty good place. You know, the weather today is absolutely outstanding. And, you know, I got to admit, I don't like football, and I thought the fan zone was pretty hideous. And I don't know who UEFA paid to do the whole branding and get-up of the games with the turquoise and purple, but it's all a bit shocking. But even I quite enjoyed the time down the fan zone, I have to admit.
Brilliant.
In the deepest recesses.
Bruce, we'll have to send you down there again. And in fact, if anyone wants to head to Kiev Bruce Leishman will take you to a fan zone, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Bruce, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. In the next half hour on Midori House, we're going to be talking about Monocle's Quality of Life survey and discussing the city that came fifth, Munich. And we'll also have some music from the Monocle Country Fair. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Steve. The Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has today finished the last leg of her trip to the Norwegian capital, Oslo, with a joint appearance with U2 lead singer Bono, who will present her with an Amnesty International award in Dublin on Tuesday. The great conservative leader Antonis Samaras has said he would try to change the painful terms of the European Union bailout programme after being given a mandate to form a new government. Other election news now, with most of the results in for the second round runoff of Egypt's presidential election, the Muslim Brotherhood Party is claiming victory for Mohamed Morsi over Ahmed Shafiq, who was prime minister under the ousted President Hosni Mubarak. The United Nations has said that a large number of civilians are still trapped in the Syrian city of Homs by ongoing fighting. Nepalese security forces have charged at demonstrators at Kathmandu's airport today as protests erupted during the departure of Nepal's prime minister, who left for the UN Conference on Sustainable Development. The protesters claimed that the prime minister was not eligible to attend that conference as head of state, as there is currently no effective parliament in Nepal. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. The new issue of Monocle is about to hit the newsstands, and it's a big one. 16 millimetres thick, I'm told. It's our July-August double issue and our Quality of Life special, the annual look at the 25 most livable cities across the world. All this week on Midori House, we'll be taking a closer look at the top five, asking just what it is about them that makes them work. We're going to start today with this year's number five, the city of Munich. A winner back in 2010, it's fallen back a touch, partly due to urban planning issues that seem to have stalled the city's progress. In a moment, we'll cross to Munich to speak to Anne Erbauer, editor of Country Magazine and a freelancer and communications consultant there. But first, I'm joined in the studio by our editor, Andrew Tuck. Andrew, hello.
Hello.
Is that your Bavarian?
That's German, yeah, it's Bavarian.
Okay, excellent, good. We'll move on from that.
Okay.
So before we turn our attention to Munich, yes. When we look at the whole sort of top 25, are there any sort of major surprises or interesting ones to pick out that you were particularly keen to highlight at all?
No. I think what's interesting is actually we've had to kind of bow to kind of a reality this year. And the Spanish cities, which were doing pretty well because they were spending so much money after 2008 on special projects really to kind of get the economy going, as Spain has kind of slightly run out of money, those things have come to an end. And we've had to kind of move those down. And, you know, events do kind of affect positions for cities in the survey. So last year, you know, after the nuclear disaster that followed the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, we did move down the likes of Tokyo because there was just too many kind of problems, really.
Well, your quality of life is slightly reduced somewhat, yes, if you can't drink the water.
And those places have come back in. And then it's always, I always quite like it at the kind of the tail end of the survey because that's where you get the kind of real jostling for position of places getting on and off the list. And we have a new entry, which is San Francisco, which I think it's quite tough for US cities to get onto these metrics-only surveys because often they don't just do very well on really basic things like murder rates and things. But
Well, basic and important.
Well, it's amazing when you compare the kind of, you know, city sizes and you think, you know, a city like Chicago is doing incredibly well, and then you look at the murder rate and yeah, it's plummeted, but it's still in the hundreds. And you look at New York, and yeah, it's amazing that the murder rate has come down from 2,500 a decade ago to 500, but it's still 500. And then you look at a city like Munich, and or indeed Munich. And they have a population of 1.4 million, and they just had two murders last year and only 1,900 break-ins. And that's extraordinary because even when you go just a few hours on the train, if you shuttled off to Vienna, in Vienna last year they had 21 murders and 8,600 burglaries. So it makes you realise that there's something very kind of special going on within Munich.
Well, and let's talk specifically about Munich. Now we're joined by Ern Erbau on the line now. Ern, welcome to Midori House. What is it about Munich that really makes it work?
I think it's a perfect combination of certain factors that are economical, that are cultural, that are fun, and yes, and the weather. Of course, when I look outside, it's about 32 degrees tonight.
Okay, that's rubbing it in a bit for the rest of us.
Okay, Munich, I think, is a really well-managed and well-run city. It has quite a good administration since many years, probably since the Olympics in 1972, which were a restart for Munich. It has now some of the best opportunities in work. It has a fantastic, it offers fantastic possibilities for leisure. So it's a very good place to live.
And yet it does have, I mean, it's fallen down a couple of places with us this year. It's not as heady heights of number one as it was 2 years ago. And there's been a couple of major urban projects like the third runway at the airport in Munich and a revamp of the public transit system that hasn't really happened. Is there any sense at all that the city might be just stagnating a little bit?
Yes, that's maybe there hasn't happened so much in the last 2 or 3 years. The city was rather busy with applying for big events like the Winter Olympics, and the big projects were on hold, such as even improving the public transport system. And the third runway was killed in a referendum yesterday, so there won't be a third runway in the airport. But still, the airport is one of the busiest in Germany and has probably the best connections apart from Frankfurt.
Andrew,
so nobody's complaining here.
No one's complained too much yet. Andrew, if you were advising the mayor of Munich on what they should be doing next, on what they could learn from elsewhere, I mean, what would you be suggesting to them?
Well, I think Anne's correct in that the city has a very enviable record. And I think that what's interesting also about Munich is it's different to the city that people see when they go as a tourist. So I think when you go as a tourist, it looks kind of incredibly conservative and so pristine that you forget that actually behind those facades, it's actually quite a fun city and there's an amazing amount of cultural life going on. I think that some of the things that hold back Germany in our survey, Munich in our survey, are the same things that hit Berlin and the rest of Germany. They're simple things to do with opening hours, the way that the cities, all German cities, tend to be pretty much closed on a Sunday and even on a Saturday afternoon for retail. For the kinds of people who read Monocle, they tend to be leading lives which are pretty 24/7. And sometimes those restrictions on the way that German cities are run are a bit brutal when you've just got off a flight and on a Saturday afternoon you can't come buy your food.
Yes, we are rather Catholic in that way.
Anne, I mean, the same question to you, Mary. What are the things that you would, if you were advising the mayor, if you could sort of change three things about your city, what would they be?
Improve cycling routes in the city, although it's already very good. But I think Copenhagen is really the benchmark here, and other cities have moved faster in cycling, in improving cycling, than Munich has in the last year. Yes, I think it would be very important to create space for young creative people. I think the creative class can afford Munich only after they had some success. It's because most of young creative people go to Berlin. I think that would be very, very important to create workspace for them and also living spaces that are affordable. And yes, number three is certainly other better opening hours. Also, Munich people tend to go to the countryside by 7 o'clock or even 4 o'clock on a Friday. So we milk the cows there.
And you mentioned Berlin. I mean, is there a sense that in Munich that you are sort of competing with other cities in Germany all the time? That because there's a number of, there's Berlin, there's Hamburg, Cologne as well, that always sort of are jostling for position in our survey. does Munich as a city sense that it's really got to stay at the top to keep its edge?
This is a debate that is never raised by Munich people. It's always raised by Hamburg or Berlin people. That's what I observe. I don't want to be, you know, I don't say that this is not a question that should be discussed, but in Munich you can... the type of work that you do in Munich is very, very different from what you do in Berlin. If you look at the creative industries and at young people, they are in Berlin. But if you look at where is actually a great product created that's successful on the world market, then please look at BMW. That's in Munich, and also designers, the most famous and most successful designers in Germany, such as Konstantin Gertrich, they live in Munich, and because they have very good working conditions here, and they have the clients come here. Here's where you may actually make money, and the money for Berlin, which is actually a bankrupt city, is made in Munich and other places.
Annabelle, on that note, which I'm sure all Berliners will be slightly annoyed about, but even though it might be accurate, thank you very much. That was Anne Erbau, editor of Country Magazine, and Andrew Tuck here in the studio. Thank you very much indeed. Tomorrow we're going to turn our attention to number four, which, despite having a slightly higher crime rate than Munich, is apparently slightly better, and that's Vienna. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
To keep up to date on the latest issue of Monocle, new films on our website, products in our shops, and new programmes on Monocle 24, sign up for our free weekly bulletin. We'll tell you about special Monocle events and make sure you're ahead of the curve with all the happenings at Midori House. Just go to monocle.com to subscribe. Let's stay in touch.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Now, at yesterday's Monocle Country Fair, the highlight, I think pretty much everyone agreed, was the petting zoo. And that inspired our New York Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears, who was in town for the fair, to write this little monologue about why petting zoos are necessary in the city.
There were some unusual sounds to be heard from the editorial floor of Midori House over the weekend. Alongside the warm tones reverberating from the live bands playing in our performance space and the hubbub of the guests attending our inaugural summer fair, the odd pig oink and sheep bleat could also be heard. Amongst stalls selling everything from Welsh lavender hand cream to Maison Kitsune's latest collection, as well as a face painting station and Bill Granger's team cooking up a storm in the kitchen, was a petting zoo that was home to goats, sheep, rabbits, chickens, and even a pig called Nathan. While many of the petting zoo's biggest fans were probably under 10 years old, the spectacle also captivated visiting adults as well as Monocle staff. On Saturday morning, when the animals from the mini farm, a travelling mobile petting zoo, arrived, half of Monocle's editorial team could be found snapping pictures with Nathan the pig or cooing at the newborn baby goats. By the second day of the fair, word had spread around Marylebone that the farm was in town and dozens of families turned up asking to be pointed straight in the direction of the petting zoo. While keeping farm animals in urban environments can draw up connotations of cruelty and mistreatment, Midori House's first and rather spacious petting zoo was clearly a success. City farms featuring our four-legged friends can add a lot to the urban environment. And if you don't have space for a full farmyard, perhaps a pet pig or goat in the garden would bring a little rural idyll to a city home. Now that the Monocle Summer Fair is over for this year, Londoners can easily visit some farmyard favourites at Hackney City Farm, which is home to pigs, goats, ducks and even a donkey. Opened in 1984, the community-run location offers inner-city locals the opportunity to experience farming and non-domestic animals at first hand. Our pop-up petting zoo at Midori House got me thinking that farm animals should make more regular appearances in the city. Perhaps city parks could devote a corner to sheep, who could in turn keep the lawn at a decent length. A community chicken coop could provide neighbourhoods with fresh eggs. The key is to follow Hackney Farm's example, and make sure farm animals rotate between a city home and a more rural pasture often. I think a pet pig can make quite a nice addition to Midori House. For Monocle, I'm Aisha Spears.
Now, we played you a little bit of music from the Country Fair earlier in the show, and we're going to play you a little bit more now. On Sunday, Cecilia Stalin played for us live in the performance space. In a moment, we'll give you a little bit of an interview that Tara Brulé did with her. But first of all, this is one of her songs that she performed live. This is Waltz for Coop.
Celia, welcome to Studio One. Off the back of an absolutely brilliant performance at the Monocle Country Fair, it was absolutely brilliant. It was great to hear something old. I can't believe that when you collaborated with Coop, it was 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Where did the time go?
I don't know. And believe me, we didn't record it in 2001. We recorded it earlier.
Really?
Yes.
That's remarkable.
I remember that day that I recorded Waltz for Coop. Like yesterday, I remember the feeling I had when I walked out of the studio, in the studio. I remember literally every step. And I don't know why that one moment is so clear to me.
And yet, it's incredible also how that particular song has also endured as well. There's a certain there's certain timelessness to it, isn't there?
There is elements of it that has a long history. So like the green sleeve bass line, and also the start of the melody does remind you of the Debussy. So I think that there are elements of it, but I also think that the main thing why it's timeless is because of their sound.
Mm.
They just did something that was a mix in between jazz and classic and ambient. And I think a lot of people can put it on, even if jazz is not their thing, they can still relate to it. And yeah,
and this was at a time when you were living in Sweden. You're now resident in London.
Yes, absolutely.
You've been here for, I guess, well, the better part of half a decade at this point.
Well, I guess the better decade.
And the move to London versus being in Sweden, because it's incredible when you look at quite a small market. You're talking 9 million people in Sweden, but the power that Sweden has, not just off the back of yet another Eurovision win this year, it's incredible the strength and power that Sweden has musically globally, given the size of the country.
Yeah, I think it's because of our Swedish heritage. Our Swedish folk music is all based on strong melodies. And I think with a strong melody, you can go so far, whether it's a backline or it's actually the melody, like you never did, right? Mm. So I think a strong melody will get you everywhere, and I think that that's anyone from the Martin team to Robin, or so it doesn't really matter, or Coop. They're all very different, but they all have that the melodies are really, really strong.
So that strong melody got you to London.
Yes.
So what's happening in London?
I am working with two different bands for this album. The album's called Step Like a Giant. It is a collaboration between me and loads of producers that I've picked out. I've done arrangements, sent that over to them, and it all based on songs by John Coltrane, all songs that John Coltrane used to play, like the song that you just heard, Favourite Things. And then right now I'm doing two versions. I'm doing Step Like a Giant, what you just heard today. And then another one is called Coltrane Away, where it's more beboppy, just straight ahead, where I've done Wakefield Jazz Club, Oxford Jazz Festival and stuff like that. So, okay. Yeah. And then I'm teaching.
Teaching?
Yeah. I'm a vocal coach.
Oh, this is great news. So you know that you missed a very big vocal evening in North London last night. Half of this building went out for a big karaoke evening. So we will have to invite you along. And we've had other members of the Swedish musical mafia out singing with us of an evening.
So that is something I cannot turn down.
Okay. So anyway, next time. We will do that. Plans for the summer. Where are you going to be performing? When is the new collaboration going to be available for global consumption? Let us know.
Absolutely. My next gig is down at the Hideaway on Thursday. And then I'm doing a Jazz FM radio interview on Thursday too. And then I'm going to go to South Africa. And then I'm going to go on vacation. And then I'll be back in London in August. And if you want to check out my music, go to Bandcamp plus Cecilia Stalin, or go to my webpage, ceciliastalin.com.
Now, to send us off, should we maybe do Favourite Things?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, why don't we listen to that? Cecilia Stalin, thank you very much for chatting to us. And thanks for absolutely stunning performance in our space. We'd love to have you back anytime.
Thank you so much.
But before that, we will go and do karaoke some night.
Yay!
Okay, okay. Here's Favourite Things.
Some kittens, brown copper kettles with woolen mittens, brown paper packaging this time of its dream. These are a few of my favorite things. So girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes, snowflake the stain on my nose and eyelashes, silver for winters that melt into spring. These are a few of my favorite. Favorite things are good girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes.
And that was Cecilia Stalin performing at Monocle's Country Fair over the weekend. And that's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. The producer was Dawn Trump, the researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, the studio manager Sam Impey. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Culture Show with Robert Bound, who paid his yearly visit to the small Swiss town with the world's biggest art fair to see who's been buying, what the word on the carpeted aisle was, and whether Art Basel is still king of the fairs.
I think the people in the education systems here are so wonderfully trained at looking at art, and I think so many families raise children with the idea that culture is integral to their upbringing.
That's up next on Culture. Aisha and Hugo are here with Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.